Okay, at the end of the day, you heard some good presentations, got deep into the strategy, how it's been used, heard a partner's perspective on the change in practice that took place when community health workers began to use it. So, you know, it could be time for the eyes to glaze over, especially as I'm going to start talking about democracy. What could this possibly have to do with democracy? So feel free to do that. Take out your smartphone if you like. You know, feel comfortable, feel at home. But we're going to make a pitch here. We're going to make a case that the work that's done on the ground by people like the community health workers, by in the waiting rooms, in places where people are engaging with public and publicly funded systems, has something to do with democracy. And that's what I'm going to share with you. So, the no relationships to disclose, you know, I have some problems with that term. I actually have tremendous colleagues here. We have a great working relationship. So I want to disclose that. The work here is based on being able to collaborate with my partners at the Right Question Institute and to find partners like Pano in the field who are grounded, understand what's happening on the ground, and are also visionaries. And that's a rare combination, and we really appreciate that opportunity. And even though APHA's criteria are so strange in terms of what's a relationship and what's not, I also want to include the Miller Innovation Fund, because support for this really requires having an imagination, having a vision about why the work on the ground connects to our larger needs to make democracy work better. So thank you all. Those are the relationships I've disclosed here. Okay, what is the use of the strategy in community health centers in New York, community health workers in Massachusetts, have to do with democracy? Well, this is what the patient said beforehand. I didn't know I could ask questions. I didn't know what decisions are made. I didn't know what a decision was. I didn't know how to ask questions. So, like Lou said, we teach just two skills, how to ask better questions and how to participate effectively in decisions. And this is our framework for accountable decision making. We talked about before there are three things to look at. She had you do a quick experience in that, in thinking about the reason for decision, the process, and the role. Patients become more effective when they ask questions about reason, process, and role. Now, Jerome Groopman, who has written a lot about doctors and doctor-patient communications, has, you know, in his book, How Doctors Think, makes, in a sense, an argument for what we're talking about. He writes, I can have another vital partner who helps improve my thinking, a partner who may, with a few pertinent and focused questions, protect me from the cascade of cognitive pitfalls that cause misguided care. That partner is present in the moment when flesh and blood decision-making occurs. That partner is my patient or her family member or friend. Patients who questioned me about a diagnosis, how I arrived at it, what other conditions I considered, and why I discounted them. You note how he has the structure, framework, that he's looking at different aspects. There's reason, process, and role that needs to be thought about, have helped me think more deeply. Many laymen feel inhibited about asking questions, but the questions are perfectly legitimate. Patients can learn to question and to think the way a doctor should. So going from patients can learn to how do patients learn is basically the bridge that we're building. Asking better questions and participating effectively in decisions are essential advocacy skills, essential partnering skills, essential shared decision-making skills. I think it would be hard to argue with that. We're making a case that these are also democratic skills. Look at these again. Asking better questions and participating effectively in decisions are also democratic skills. In a democracy, we should expect and require that all decisions be guided by the following criteria. There should be legitimate reasons. Decisions are based on policy, standards, rules that are fairly applied, not based on discriminatory reasons, on arbitrary decision-making, unjustified decisions, but they need to be legitimate. There should be transparency. The process used to make the decision should be visible to all. The opportunities for participation. There's a role in the decision-making process for the individual affected by the decision. These are essential criteria for accountable decision-making in a democracy. Take one of them away, and you undermine the decision-making process. So we demonstrate how when we teach people how to ask questions about reasons, they're actually raising their expectations, expecting legitimate reasons. When we're teaching them to ask questions about process, they're learning to expect transparency, that they have a right to know. And when we're teaching people about to ask questions about their role, they're learning about identifying where are there opportunities for them to participate and have a voice. So, where are the skills of asking questions and participating in decisions relevant in a democracy? Well, this is traditional forms of democratic action in low-income communities, and a lot of our work has focused on low-income communities. A number of you have mentioned a range of sites where, you know, working with migrant workers, working in tribal areas, working with low-income patients, also been used for people with special needs, people working on Special Olympics, and for chronic disease specific and the kind of cancer work that you've done for the American Cancer Society. So it's been used in a range of areas, but if you look at traditional forms of democratic action in low-income communities, you look at the levels of action or participation in traditional forms, lobbying, letters to the editor, community organizing, public hearings, demonstrations, mobilization, and once every 4 years, a kind of a one-day activity of voting, which is still at a much lower rate in low-income communities than in other communities. So what we've looked at is how to change that, how to think differently about it. And we've developed the concept of outposts of democracy. Those are the places where people are coming into contact with public and publicly funded agencies. So all the way from the left to the column at the far right are what you see is the scale of the traditional forms of democratic action. And then in the column on the far right, you see that green block there is there are 62 million Medicaid encounters a year. That is 62 million interactions with the Medicaid system per year. And then you look at the other ones in terms of welfare, SSI, WIC, school lunch, public housing, food stamps, a range of individual encounters with outposts of democracy. Why are they outposts of democracy? Because they exist only because of decisions made further up the decision-making chain in democracy. They would not exist if those decisions had not been made. So our argument is that there's opportunities there to begin to build people's capacity to participate in decisions. So there are over 100 million encounters a year with public and public-funded agencies. In tens of millions of these encounters, too few people are participating in decisions that affect them. These encounters on a micro level are the endpoints of their engagement with the public sector. If people do not perceive themselves playing a role at the micro level, why should we expect them to participate in democratic action on any other level? And if you think about it, a lot of the lobbying work and the advocacy work that APHA is trying to do and to get people more involved and take more action and have a say in decisions that are made in Washington at the state level is about trying to get people to participate in traditional forms of democratic action. But what's been missing is looking at those tens of millions of encounters that the people who APHA members are serving are having with public agencies, and yet they're not participating there. So we're trying to make a case for thinking differently about, instead of trying to get people to move from here to over here to participate in decision-making in democracy, is how do you begin to build that capacity where they are? That's the democratic potential. So we need more people participating on all levels of democracy. They could become opportunities to practice democratic skills, transforming the experience on the micro level from an endpoint of engagement to a new starting point for individual action and democratic action. So we've given a name to this, microdemocracy. Microdemocracy is individuals using essential democratic skills to participate effectively in decisions made in their ordinary encounters with public and publicly funded institutions. Democracy, like healthcare, needs people who participate, take ownership of what needs to be done, and see the whole picture and understand the idea of a system that includes many people with many different needs. The right question, effective patient strategy makes participation at the micro level possible in healthcare as well as in democracy. Thank you.
Thank you all for the presentations. So now we would like to open the floor to questions that you have. Yes.
Yes, the question formulation technique is under a Creative Commons license, which means that we encourage people to use it, just they need to attribute it, not use it commercially, and share it.
And
if you, online, we at the right questions, rightquestion.org, you can find resources, you can join. It's called an educator network, but all this in healthcare is educational work, and you can access resources.
And at some point, we will be building a network focusing just on healthcare. But for now, you can get the general process of the question formulation technique in the network for educators. And it's free, and we will not bother you a lot. Like every 4 months, we will send you an update on the work that the Right Question Institute is doing. Yes, and then you.
So we've done a lot of work in education, and a lot of special education, special ed teachers have used it, and have talked about the changes they've seen with students with significant cognitive impairment, on how this actually opens up apparently a new way of thinking, a new ability to figure things out and problem solve. It's basically a problem solving strategy, because if you're able to identify decisions and learn how to ask your own questions about it, you're figuring out how to deal with that. So part of it is it shifts the traditional form from trying to give people information and hope that they'll be able to use it to actually building their capacity to become problem solvers.
Wondering if this is all like a verbal interaction, or is, you know, I know a lot of times when I go to the doctor with my child, like I have a clipboard and answers and all that, is some of that, are there aids to help people in terms of forming their questions?
Yeah, I mean, so definitely it's helpful to have someone coaching there. I mean, that's both the waiting rooms in New York and also in Somerville, we did have someone coaching them on how to use the strategy. But we've developed materials that basically guide the patient through it step by step. And so we're also looking at, you know, videos. What are some other ways of getting the strategy out there where you might not even need a person doing the coaching? Mm.
And if you go back to the experience I gave you, I took you through a step-by-step process in which you produce your own questions. You improve the questions when you look at the different types of questions that you were asking and when you prioritize. And then what we didn't do here was to strategize on how to use the questions, which is another step in which people think about, okay, so I learned this, how can I use it, where can I use it? So those same steps that I took you through, you can use to coach people. And about the only thing that you will have to do is a shift in practice, like Dan mentioned, because it is not about making that mistake that we made years ago in giving the questions. It is about prompting people so they can ask their own.
Sure. We actually have a booth downstairs, and tomorrow you can talk to more people about it if you have a chance to stop by. But just very briefly, the education work was kind of a byproduct. Our core work has been about teaching people how to advocate for themselves, and that work grew out of our work in low-income communities all around the country. And as a byproduct of that, some teachers began to use their strategy in the classroom, and all of a sudden they saw levels of student engagement and participation that they had never seen before. And so Harvard Education Press came to us and asked us to write a book about it. And Luce and I wrote a book about it with great difficulty, but we wrote it. And now tens of thousands of people around the country and around the world who are using the strategy in the classroom. And somebody was asking before about what level it's used at. It's from K through graduate school. And it's been remarkable at how teachers have just warmed up to this and been so excited seeing what the changes are. So that's, it's interesting because the research, there's more research been done on our limited work in healthcare than there has been in education. But because the book is out in education, the word is around the world, and there's the network that you can join, you can access on the resources called an educator network, has people from all over, and they're accessing it that way. And there's basically just one thing, is on that, what we emphasize in the teaching of the classroom use is that there are three skills that are taught, the three abilities that are developed: divergent thinking, convergent thinking, and metacognition. So these are relevant to educators as they
Have you compared this from a one-on-one standpoint and a group standpoint? Can you see any improvement in
Most of our work has been done in group settings, and it engages people. They help each other. The dynamic is a beautiful dynamic about how they collaborate. In one-on-one, we started recently doing that because of the work of some people in the field, in which their job was not to facilitate groups. So therefore, if you give them an experience working in groups, they will not know how to adjust that. So, but I know that it works, is excellent in groups, and what I have seen with the outreach workers, the community health workers at Network Health, it is that it also works well when you coach one-on-one.
I just want to give you one suggestion. Because I think that Luz did a lot of work in order to make this session happen, and if you go back and you think about this and you want to share any thoughts, I think it'd be great. We don't have an evaluation form for you because that's not part of the conference protocol, but we're always interested in learning from people. So if you write down Luz, L-U-Z, at rightquestion.org, you can reach her directly. And we are also going to be offering more seminars on our work in healthcare. And so if you're interested in that, you'll be able to learn about it.
So any other questions that you have, reflections, comments for us, please feel free to email to us. Yes.
Could you speak up a little?
Addition to what they were doing.
And you used the right word, complement. It doesn't supplant, replace, it complements, it can be integrated, it becomes a resource. Now, we have our own bias in the sense that, what we hear from the field is that it's a transformational skill. It's not just one of 20, but that actually when people become activated, empowered, take action when they learn the skill. So it's slipped in as something simple to add, but it actually becomes transformational.
Thank you.
I'm curious, given your experience so far, and I know it's still preliminary, what do you see as the next steps to try to bring this approach to scale, to expand the impact and make comparison of the functional book in the educational sector? Do you see steps of that sort, or how do you get sort of greater adoption or broader experimentation?
I think that really is the question that we're working on this year, and Becca is, we have capacity now to begin to look at that. And I think that is the question that we're looking at, and I think that we feel that the model exists, we understand what the challenges are. Our work with the network health was instrumental, and you know, as we shared with you before, all the mistakes that you make along the way help you create a better product. And I think that I think that's where before I came up here, I had a conversation with Wiley Publishing House, and looking at, you know, how are they putting education materials out there, and they're very interested in talking with us about it. And I think that because of the track record in education, where again we're not in the field of education, but boom, it's taken off, and it's on a field that's very attractive to publishers, and I think that that may be the best way for us to get the word out there and then create demand.
There also could be, we've got community health worker certification, and starting in Massachusetts, they have actually a specific, at least you could get that in the curriculum, and it will be an interesting thing to try to work to have that be part of the training, the core.
Yeah, Becca and I went recently to a meeting about the competencies that community health workers should have, and be aware that being able to identify, to help patients identify decisions and ask questions is not in the competencies.
Not yet, I know.
Or not yet, yes. But hopefully it will soon.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you for coming.